Blog Talk Radio.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Cindy F. Solomon, live on Blog Talk Radio for today's Global Product Management Talk. Today we are talking with Sean Dakin, who is a social media expert, specializes in brand building, management and marketing, and especially issues surrounding public and private information. He started a nonprofit, the National Political Do Not Contact Registry, in 2007 to fight for voters' privacy rights and to fight against those evil political robocalls. In the space of a year, he took that organization from a startup to over 200,000 members, and he became the spokesperson for voter privacy throughout the nation. During that time, he testified in the U.S. Senate, was on CNN, MSNBC, NPR, XM Radio, NBC, CBC, and ABC. And we're delighted to now have you on Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
He's most proud of helping to introduce the Robocall Privacy Act with Senator Feinstein. Sean, would you like to add to that?
No, I think that was more than enough. I'm pleased to be here and excited to participate in this product management chat.
So you used to be a software product manager?
Yes. I started my life at FedEx in the 1990s and was a software product manager there and helped actually introduce tracking to the internet for FedEx and shipping, and really enjoyed it and got introduced to pragmatic marketing with Steve Johnson and went through all of that training. After FedEx, I went to go work for WebMethods, which was a middleware company that was pretty hot and during the dot-com era. Was a product marketing manager there. Then I worked the infamous Fannie Mae and was a product manager in their e-business group doing mortgage product management. So I've been doing product management for a while. I was also the SVP of product management at a company called IXI Corporation, which is a data company selling marketing information services to financial services companies for about a year or so. I've been doing a lot of product management, but I don't do it anymore in terms of officially for a company. I do it for myself. In stuff that I'm doing, and I'm about ready to launch a new product called ReverseRobocall.com, where you can robocall computerized generated phone calls. You can robocall your own politician as much as you would like. I'm one of the product managers on that particular application.
Excellent. So how does that reverse robocall work?
Sure. It's pretty simple. So it's in reaction to the fact that politicians are exempt from the Do Not Call registry, which is donotcall.gov, and I really recommend that everybody, if you're not already registered at donotcall.gov, please register yourself to stop telemarketing spam. But of course, when the politicians wrote the law, they exempted themselves from the law. And so they can pretty much robocall you whenever they want. They can call your cell phones. They can call your home phones. They can call whenever and whatever they want to call. In reaction to that, of course, I started the National Political Do Not Contact Registry in 2007 to create a Do Not Call list specifically for political calls, but realized that the market, if it works, the market mechanisms could be incredibly powerful. I partnered with Aaron Titus, who is also a privacy advocate. He works for Identity Finder, which is a reputation management, but identity looking for social security numbers that shouldn't be on enterprise systems and stuff like that. Reverse robocall is set up and it's going to be launching pretty soon to allow voters or anybody to record a robocall and send that robocall to one or many politicians. For example, you would go to reverserobocall.com, which is not set up yet, but we're accepting emails at reverserobocall.com for the launch, which is in a couple of weeks. You go there and you would say, who do you want to call? And so let's just say you want to call Rick Perry, or you want to call all Republican presidential candidates. So you click on call all Republican presidential candidates, and then the next screen says, please give us your phone number and we will call you and you can record your call. Put in your telephone number, The system makes a call. You record your call to the politicians, so there's, in this case, Republican presidential candidates, and then you press accept. And then the next screen, you would pay. Not a lot of money. We don't have the pricing down yet. Product management, part of that is pricing, so we're doing some pricing research and analysis on that, but not a lot of money. Probably about $3.99 or $4.99.
John, our co-host Adrian Chan from Australia, Brainmates, just came in.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Sean. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
He's been telling us about this new product that he is launching, which is the reverse robocall that prevents politicians from calling you, which is a big issue here. I don't know if that's an issue in Australia.
No, yeah. No politician calls us. They wouldn't care about us.
Once people have essentially recorded their robocall to the politicians, the system, using a voice over IP API to a company called Tropo, makes one or many phone calls. Then we send an email saying, congratulations, we've made our phone calls for you. Thanks very much. Very simple, very visceral, and it really allows voters to talk back to politicians the way that they talk to us. That's just a little bit of product management that I'm doing on the side, but I really spend a lot of time in the privacy world, which is why we're here today and really thinking long and hard about data privacy and how that applies to particularly to businesses. And in this case, really to think about how it applies to product managers.
Yep, fantastic. We have a do not call register here in Australia. If you register with do not call, companies technically shouldn't be able to call you to disturb you and harass you and sell you stuff.
Right. We have that same thing here in the United States, but of course the politicians exempted themselves from the law.
Oh.
At least in the United States, though.
Wow.
I've also opened up the lines for other people to call in. We're getting quite sophisticated here. I have someone else on the line. I'm not sure who it is. Hello.
Probably Jason Brett.
Ah, Jason Brett. Welcome. You're a little scratchy.
Well, that's because I didn't shave this morning.
Sean and Adrian, can you hear Jason?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I can scratchy Jason, too.
Sure.
Awesome. So just a little side. Adrian has been on vacation for 2 weeks, and welcome back. We're glad to have you. We had some great discussions while you were gone. Roger Coven was our co-host last week.
Fantastic.
And the previous week was Erica Anderson. They were both excellent. You can see the recap of the shows complete with summary and podcast on our website blog at prodmanagementtalk.com. I had to surprise you when you came back, Adrian, by adding new features into our talk.
Fantastic.
So the ability to have callers call in, we haven't determined yet if it's a value add enhancement.
Excellent.
We do have a couple of people in the room. Erica Anderson is here. Jason Brett is here. I think Matt McCoy is here.
Hi, Matt. He's on his iPhone. He's listening to us.
He can hear us also.
Yeah.
And I'm also using this Twitter tool called joint.im/channel/prodmanagementtalk, which is a new tool that I just discovered, although Sean told me he's used it before, for managing Twitter chat. I suggest that people use Tweet Chat as the easiest tool. This tool adds a side chat, which would be great if I had two or four more hands to manage all the things that are happening.
We have a new person joining us, Giuliano. He's on hold with Comcast, so he says he may as well be doing something productive.
Awesome.
Well,
so I have to also let people know that if you want to call in, you need to tweet to let me know that you're waiting to come in, because the studio doesn't tell me that someone's on hold. Thank you. I see Jason is typing. If you want to let me know something on the side, you can let me know in the chat. So welcome, J3 Giuliano. Okay, if you are developing web or mobile applications, data privacy and security are front and center, particularly in 2011. In Washington, D.C., both the White House and Congress are extremely interested in doing something about protecting the privacy of consumers. Last May alone, there were three hearings in Congress on privacy, data breaches, and mobile geolocation. Sean Bacon is a fellow at the Future of Privacy Forum, and today he has answers to everything you need to know about web privacy but were afraid to ask. The one that he suggested is, what is going on in Washington right now regarding data privacy issues? Any of us aware of what is going on? Please answer.
Sure. I will answer verbally and then hopefully get some Twitter action in as well. Yeah, this year has definitely been the year of activity around privacy, particularly in Washington, D.C. And so I was just looking at, somebody has this great list here that I'm going to tweet out here about how many pieces of legislation have been introduced so far this year. The latest I have here is about 18 separate pieces of legislation have been introduced this year alone, all having something to do with data privacy. And that's kind of unheard of in the last 10 years. And so, for example, we have something from Jackie Speier. He's a Democrat from California. The Do Not Track Me Online Act of 2001. We also have Senators Kerry and McCain introducing the Commercial Privacy Bill of Rights Act of 2011. We have Senator Jay Rockefeller introducing the Do Not Track Act of 2011. The point here is that Congress seems to be very, very, very interested in this. And this is really coming with the incredible growth of mobile, right? And then story after story of people finding out that somebody's tracking their movements online, and Congress and senators really trying to figure out who's on first here. There was a point in the spring and the summer where we were probably having about 2 hearings on Capitol Hill a week. I couldn't even keep up with. So this is a link I'm going to shoot out here showing you all the different private hearings that are going on. And the takeaway here is, if you are doing anything with customer data, if you're creating products with customer data, which is pretty much most of you, if you're doing product management around software, it's really important to kind of keep on top of privacy and data issues and think about it as you're doing requirements documents at the beginning of the requirement phase rather than at the end of the requirement.
That's a great point.
Here's the thing that I question, Sean. Anyone who's been involved with the web and doing web services or even websites, SEO, they've been aware of the ability to track for over 10 years. Why has it taken so long for it to become of concern?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So we did have a big spate of privacy hearings in 99 and 2000. So that's probably what you're referring to. We've been talking about this for a long time, particularly around online behavioral advertising, and now this whole do not track mechanism discussion. We thought that we were going to have something, you know, essentially baseline privacy legislation passed, and then something called 9/11 happened. And 9/11, as you well know, transformed many parts of our lives and many parts of the government, and introduced something called the Patriot Act, which is, of course, is a whole other discussion, but really essentially said that security trumps privacy. And the whole locus of the discussion, at least in Washington, D.C., moved from any interest in data privacy for consumers to how do we protect our nation. So the discussion itself just was no longer a priority. You know, there were other priorities, as you can imagine, for the nation. So that's what happened. And so now the question is, why now? And I think why now is because of, as I said, this incredible growth of mobile, of web app, of Facebook, of the fact that back in 2000, not that many Americans were actually online being tracked. Now, many, many, many more Americans are online. And the magnitude of the issue is just much, much larger.
Got it. This is primarily a U.S.-centric issue, Adrian?
Privacy and security is always an issue, but I'm not quite sure whether it's got the same level of, what's the word? I won't say importance, but it's something that people are aware of, but it's not always top of mind. We're not as affected by the 9/11 event. So perhaps we're a little bit more isolated from sort of security issues.
And also, if no big brands or no government organizations have been hit or hacked, then it wouldn't be an issue until then.
You know, we know that some big brands have been hacked. Sony, for example, all their data was hacked. I'm not sure whether it happened in the US probably a few months ago. Banks are definitely aware of security and data issues. The attitude is that, I guess, if it's a problem and it affects me, then I'll fix it then, as opposed to sort of taking any precautionary measures.
Sean, you had Sony in the questions, actually.
Definitely, there's increasing focus on costs of having to deal with data breaches. In this case, it's a data breach and hacking and what happens to customer data. And some of those 18 pieces of legislation around data breach legislation, because there really isn't any right now, and Congress is trying to figure out what to do. So there could be a significant cost just in terms of fines. But of course, from a business perspective, the cost is lost trust, your reputation, customer attrition, all of those things. It's just really, really important, essentially, to think long and hard about how much data do you really need? What data do you need to collect? What are you going to do with that data? How are you going to protect and secure that data? Where are you going to store that data? All of those things are incredibly important. And so today, actually, the Wall Street Journal wrote a story about how privacy profession and the largest and medium-sized organizations are now getting larger and larger seats at the table. And they're not just lawyers doing compliance work, which of course is incredibly important, but also leaders in the organization. And one of the best organizations in terms of leading thinking is Intuit. So Intuit with Quicken and all of their software products. They are one of the leaders in thinking about how do we protect this data, what data do we collect, and then how do we communicate this, and how do we communicate trust to our customers? And of course, in a financial services arena, protecting that data is absolutely vital. If you lose that data, you've lost your customer for life.
So product managers have to not only think of our customer, but also recognize all the data associated with the customer.
Right, exactly. And so it's just really important to think about that. So in the last 24 hours, we've had three major corporations get into hot water: Facebook and Spotify, and then Facebook by itself, and then OnStar. So the one that got a lot of attention today was, in the last 24 hours, was OnStar. All right, so GM has a wonderful technology that tracks you and helps provide emergency information and navigation. And if you're in a crash, it can help locate you. So they made a teeny little change to their terms of service and their privacy statement last week, saying essentially that even if you cancel your subscription with OnStar, they will continue to track you as you drive around the country. That set off a firestorm, with Senator Chuck Schumer calling for investigations today, and pretty much any major newspaper reporting about it today because of that. And so the question is, why did OnStar do that? Did they communicate it in the right way? And obviously, the communications was not done in the right way. And the answer to why they were doing it is data is really important. And said that they were doing it to collect data for traffic patterns and to help municipalities and to understand driving patterns and all that kind of stuff. But the bottom line is that they didn't say that this was an opt-in thing. It essentially said it was an opt-out thing. And so that's a big, big bone of contention, particularly in the privacy community, is that much of this technology, Facebook, everything else, is by default opt-in, right? And so when you make something default opt-in, obviously you're going to get more customers to do it. But in this case, OnStar has been put in the middle of the crosshairs of this particular public relations disaster. So it just seems to be happening more and more. And I think something that's starting to grow is communications shops, public relations agencies, who are starting to create trust, security, and privacy practices for these exact issues, so that General Motors and OnStar, they actually think really long and hard before they make significant changes.
Excellent. So that covered Q1, what is going on in Washington right now, and it was literally right now, regarding data privacy issues. So just to read some of the tweets that have come in, Mac McCoy said it regarding the OnStar, it's a perfect example of why I'll avoid any vehicle with OnStar.
Can you tell us what OnStar is?
Sure. OnStar is essentially, think of it as a global positioning system, two-way data system that's built into cars, in this case General Motors cars, and people pay a subscription for it, but it gives them, you know, if they have a crash, it will notify General Motors, it will notify OnStar, and they'll call the police and they'll locate it. If you're lost, it will provide directions for you. It's incredibly popular and people love it, but obviously there's huge privacy data issues there, because they're tracking you and they're tracking what you're doing and how fast you're going and all that stuff.
Right. Okay. Gotcha.
And a lot of those applications now are available on smartphones. Before they were readily available, OnStar had this service.
Yeah.
It's seen as a added feature or a desirable feature to sell cars.
Of course, yeah. It's an exclusive product benefit. And if you're buying a car, some people may say, well, you know, I'm going to buy a General Motors car because they have OnStar and nobody else does.
Right.
It's a competitive advantage. It's been very, very popular. And it's a very interesting case study about the startup of it and everything else. But they've just been put in the hot seat in the last 24 hours, mostly because they just didn't think very clearly. And then their response, of course, was very corporate and very much essentially, we do this because we can. And we promise not to do anything bad. And maybe they could have gotten away with that 10 years ago before social media and technology, but somebody who was particularly well aware of how to do that essentially said, this is wrong, posted it up on the internet, posted his response. The media took notice of it. And now Senator Schumer, who's a Democrat from New York, one of the most powerful Democratic senators, is calling for hearings and saying that this was one of the worst privacy violations he's ever seen.
Wow.
Yeah, which of course is a lot of hyperbole there, but if you're a company, you really don't want a senator saying that about you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's some discussion going on in the Twitter stream. J3 Giuliano asked a question. Opt-in versus opt-out is a major debate in the utility industry. What is needed for opt versus what is useful otherwise? Is ops-related energy data necessary? And what of data that can be used for marketing?
He works in the energies field around smart grid technology, and so that's a whole other a privacy sphere that I don't work in, but I know enough about. But he was talking about you get a smart meter on your house instead of the old-fashioned electric meter.
Yep.
And these smart meters can do a lot of things, figure out which appliances you have and how often you use those appliances and when you use those appliances. And so there's a huge amount of discussion around privacy. And of course, what he's talking about there is opt in and opt out. You know, should people be able to opt in to utilities or opt out? Or should it be default opt out? And then you have to actually physically opt in to that kind of stuff? Or should it just be all just kind of done on the side? And so that's a whole other example that the smart grid community is having to deal with.
And it's a great example. Here in California, PG&E, which is the Pacific Gas and Electric, replaced everybody's meters. Nobody had a choice about it. So they replaced the meters with the smart meters that could automatically tell them how much electricity and gas we're using without having to send someone out to read them. And then there was a problem that the meters were transmitting the wrong information and people were being billed astronomical amount because of the problem in the meter.
Right, exactly. That's what he's talking about. So that's really what we're talking about. And so the second question then is about do not track in particular, and it segues nicely into that because really what we're talking about here is it's mostly we're talking about online behavioral advertising and tracking and websites and apps tracking your behavior within an app or within an environment, within a website, and then from website to website and app to app. So the Do Not Track legislation that's being discussed is trying to give consumers the ability and the technology to raise their hand and say, I do not want to be tracked. I do not want advertisements to be sent to me based on the algorithms and the analysis that are done by the major advertising network. And so there's huge discussion about that. And I personally, coming from my do not call background, I personally think that do not track is a very bad name. It's not a useful name because the technology behind it is not at all the same as a telephone technology. The telephone technology, when you're put on a do not call list, it's very binary. It's very on or off. You get put on the do not call list, the calls stop, and you're happy. Do not track is not at all the same. It's very confusing. It's very technical. And most consumers just don't understand that at all. The bottom line is something is probably going to happen, as I read off, in both the House and the Senate, people have introduced versions of Do Not Track, and that essentially will give consumers the ability to go through their browser, either turn off or on tracking in one technical implementation, or in another technical implementation, work off of what is called a Do Not Track list. And the Do Not Track lists are being created by companies, Microsoft, and other places as well, where people can select who they want to track or not.
So there's various ways to really turn on the Do Not Track functionality. Is it a website by website, all or nothing as well?
Exactly. And so Firefox is working on a Do Not Track header that would be put in the browser. And so it could literally go with an on-off. You know, there's not a lot of fine-tuning. I, the consumer, do not want you to track me. So whenever I go to a website, that website, then of course the website would have track list, and that's being implemented by, for example, Microsoft. They're creating what is called a tracking protection list, or TPL. And so that's literally, you subscribe to a list, like you subscribe to an RSS feed or subscribe to a Twitter account. And the list is maintained by Microsoft, or you could subscribe to any number of other lists. And in that list are numbers of advertising networks that will agree not to track you if you say, please don't track me because I'm on this list. So the point here is it's not the technology. The technological solution is still being discussed. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. The industry itself is attempting to self-regulate because they would prefer not to have regulation from Washington. If they can come up and say, guess what, you've asked us to come up with a solution, which the FTC and Congress and the Department of Commerce have all done, and they can say, look, we've implemented it, and look, people are using it, then potentially there will not be any regulation.
QT was, what does someone need to know about the Do Not Track legislation, which Sean has been answering?
Yeah.
People are discussing that J3 Giuliano said, I believe people should have a choice. It may be more expensive, but it should be an option. And the current EU policy is opt-in for tracking. It must be an informed consent. U.S. proposals are opt-out.
Yeah.
And he suggested that the question should have been, so why should it be easy? In a sense, the data and what it implies is my property.
Right.
We've been conditioned to, if you don't want mom to know, don't put it on the internet. I think that might actually be a generational thing. I don't know that younger people are even concerned with anyone knowing what they're sharing. I'm constantly told that they don't care about the technology, the device. What they're using to communicate is not a big issue to them. It doesn't matter. That it's a continuous conversation across all mediums is what's important to them.
Jay Brett makes a really good point. He says that he doesn't think people aren't concerned with what people know, but how the info is abused.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what I know about you. It's just whether I use your information incorrectly.
Q3, to specifically about mobile geolocation issues.
The other set of excitement this year has been around mobile tracking, right? There was another O'Reilly conference earlier this year with a couple of researchers who said they did a bunch of research, and they found that without us even knowing, the iPhone was recording your tracking movements, you know, your movements everywhere you went, and they created this map. People love visualizations, and it was incredibly visual, and it showed that even though they thought that the iPhone was not tracking them, they haven't given the iPhone permission, that in fact the iPhone was tracking, and it was dumping that data back on the laptops that they were using, you know, to do the syncs with iTunes. If somebody wanted to get a hold of that, they could find out every single possible location where you had been in like the last 12 months. That again blew up really quickly, and Congress found out about it. Lo and behold, we had hearing. And there we had Apple, and of course Android was implicated as well. So Google was up there, and advocates, and people against the big companies, and so everybody had to get involved. But the point is when you start talking about, people get worked up a little bit about online behavioral advertisements and tracking on browsers, but when you start talking about tracking people's movements, then people get really excited about that, right? It's something that's very personal, it's very visceral. People need to figure out what to do there. So there's a lot of interest around that. That's where, in my capacity as a fellow at the Future of Privacy Forum, I worked on setting up a website where mobile developers can find out everything they want about application privacy and mobile privacy. So it's something to really pay attention to, and it's something that's moving very quickly. Applicationprivacy.org, I just tweeted it out. You can learn about all the applicable laws worldwide. You can learn about how to implement privacy by design, which is essentially thinking about it as a product manager and thinking about it in terms of putting it in your requirements documents and really baking in privacy from the beginning rather than what after you've launched. Information there that should be particularly helpful to anybody in the mobile development space.
You're tweeting from Privacy Camp, and I keep referring to you as at Sean Dakin. I did say that you tweeted from several hats.
Yeah, I have many different Twitter accounts, but Privacy Camp is something I founded, and we run every once in a while our camp around privacy in particular. I know there's product management camp, which I've been to one here in the D.C. area, which was great. We have a similar approach, methodology, you know, discussing specifically privacy issues. So I founded that in 2009, and we've had them in D.C., Toronto, and in Silicon Valley, couple other places.
So I'm looking at the website at the moment, and how can an Australian product manager use this when they're developing products?
For applicationprivacy.org?
Yeah.
They would go under resources, would be probably the best place to start.
Right.
Resources give them the requirements for the platforms, iPhone, Android, existing privacy laws, location privacy stuff, privacy research, App Store requirements. And so a lot of these are as global as we can get them to be. And if you're participating, particularly if developing for the iPhone or the Android, they're applicable. At least the terms of service that you need to be aware of are definitely applicable across the world. And there's some tools here. And I think the thing to really think about is this leading approach called privacy by design. Privacy by design comes out of Canada, Dr. Anne Kaboukian. She's been working on this for 15 years. And really has been very, very successful in getting people to really start thinking about how do we think about privacy. It's a win-win situation. It's got to be done beginning of a development cycle. So I'll tweet that out right now.
There's a discussion in the tweets, would an RFID wallet work? It's much more stylish than phones.
Who asked the question?
So it's a discussion between Matt McCoy and Erica Anderson and Jay Brett. There's an ongoing thread. If you turn the phone off, it's off from a GPS point of view. You could also put it in a tinfoil hat. So I guess an RFID wallet would be more stylish than a tinfoil hat. Also, I think Matt says, really, other phones you turn off, but someone can still listen in to offline conversations. See the Murdoch scandal.
Yes, very appropriate.
Q4, which is how can I develop web or mobile applications that incorporate leading practices with regards to data privacy? You gave us some resources and the link to your website. We actually are on to Q5. Where you mentioned, I've heard a lot about privacy by design. What does it mean? How can I incorporate PBD principles into my development process? I wonder if that dovetails with the notion of design thinking that is being discussed in innovation circles.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it's been in product management for a long time, and talking about marketing requirements documents and business requirements documents, and essentially getting the strategy right, thinking about your customers, thinking about the competition, thinking about the use cases, thinking about all the stuff that you need to think about before you actually expend resources on building product. And hopefully you've done a lot of thinking there. And so privacy by design is essentially just saying, as you're doing all that stuff that you usually are doing, thinking about your business and thinking about what the requirements look like, and as you're building out those requirements, also think about data privacy. Really, really think hard about, if you're collecting data, what are you going to do with that data? Are you going to store it? Where are you going to store it? What are you going to do with it? How are you going to communicate it? All of those kinds of issues. I'll tweet this out in a second. One of my favorite writers at Forbes, Kashmir Hill, she writes something called Not So Private Parts. She wrote a story around why privacy by design is the new corporate hotness.
Like that.
Yeah. It's a great story about what's happened there. And good, because not only, you know, people kind of talking about this, but it's also last fall and early part of this year, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the FCC launched, you know, had all these white papers and documents and green papers about asking for comments. Very, this is government, lots of bureaucracy. But one of the major recommendations they made for industry was to follow privacy by design principles. And so that is really a big, big deal right now, and why people are talking about it, because at the highest reaches of government, people are saying, yeah, this really, really makes sense. For example, this article here that Cashmere Hill talks about, I just tweeted out, this company called Fitbit, with social media, people work out, they tweet, oh, I just worked out today, and I just went running today. Well, one of the things people could do is have sex. Now, that loses calories, right? So people were putting in their app, I just had sex and I lost 500 calories. That sounds like a great idea, and I'd love to put that in my app for my own private use of tracking my calorie intake and outtake. Yeah. Little did they know that, yeah, so all of a sudden that was going into people's Twitter stream.
Oh.
And there wasn't a lot of privacy by design there, right? Really think through how people would use the app to share information. And if you have something where people are sharing information automatically about that, to give you an example, and she goes into this, is that when Google Plus launched, a big part of Google's positioning out of the gate was that they were more privacy aware than Facebook. So you can talk a lot about the circles, right? So Google Plus circles, really friend lists or whatever you want to call them. They really, really thought long and hard about privacy. Google is using that as one of their competitive differentiators with Google Plus. As my boss at the Future Privacy Forum says in this article, now, if you don't design privacy at the architectural level, it can be devilishly hard to deal with later. And that's the point. You know, like anything, if you don't design it up front, to try to retrofit it is really, really difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, there's been a couple of questions that came in. And Jason Brett had asked earlier that Facebook and Zuckerberg repeatedly say and demonstrate their view that privacy is dead. What does this mean to you, and how would it impact legislation and product best practices?
You know, Facebook is constantly pushing the envelope. They recently have obviously just done that in the last week. If you're on Facebook, you can't not have not seen what they're trying to do. And so they've gotten into trouble, of course. So as I think I referenced earlier, one of the things that happened in the last 24 hours is moving from active sharing or by design sharing. Like, I don't see if that's the right term, but if I want to share something on Facebook, I have to physically get onto Facebook usually and say, I'm eating lunch. And I have to type that in, or I have to do something. They have just come up with this term of passive sharing. And so in the last 24 hours, they're kind of getting into trouble a little bit of this with the Spotify, the music company that has just come up, just been part of their partnership with this, so that when people are logged into Spotify and logged into Facebook is automatically, and Spotify are automatically jointly sharing with your Facebook friends what you're listening to without you actually doing anything. So it's passively sharing in the background. And so people are not that happy about that. And then they figured out that, oh my goodness, Spotify is now requiring that every single Spotify user must log in using their Facebook account. So they're getting into some deep, but people are not happy with that. Privacy issues and sharing issues. But Facebook is pushing the envelope. My answer to all that kind of stuff is, who is winning, right? Facebook is winning. Last summer, there was a great Facebook, summer of 2010, everybody was going to quit Facebook of all the Facebook privacy changes, and there was a great quit Facebook day. And I think during that time, Facebook grew by like 10 million people, and maybe 30,000 people quit Facebook. So you look to the market pretty clear that Facebook is winning. They're doing some amazing stuff, but they continue to kind of lead rather than follow. And when you lead and don't follow, you're going to make yourself the target of a lot of talk, of which they constantly are, but people keep joining and they keep winning.
So does it mean, because of that, that people really don't care about privacy and their data, and that they're quite happy for it to, you know, to be used in whatever way Facebook desires it to be, because the benefits on Facebook is so much greater than any privacy issues they may experience?
So there's this whole question, is privacy dead, and do people don't care about privacy? I think Cory Doctorow had a great talk, I think at Strata this last week, about this, and it's been passed around the internet a couple of times. Everybody's watching it or reading about it. He was actually, I think, had a post in the New York Times today or yesterday about this issue. And he kind of points out, and I think this is correct, is that people just, they do care. People care about privacy. They care very deeply about privacy. But there's a huge disconnect between sharing too much information and not really knowing what you're doing, and then any eventual harm. And so he said it's kind of like smoking. You know smoking is not good for you. The harm is so far out in the future. It's very hard to make that connection. And people are also very good. Facebook is very good. Social media is very good. People see the benefits, right? My wife loves to see photos of her best friend's kids. I like to do the same thing. I like to do it for business reasons, for personal reasons. I like to read what's going on. And because it's a lot of the technology in the background is pretty complex, people just don't think about it. So I think the future of privacy is, you know, we're at the very, very, very beginning. And nobody really knows where it's going to go. But I do think people do care. I mean, all research shows that people do care. It's just, what do they care really about?
I wonder what would make people change as a group, not just individuals, where you may, I guess, experience some problem or harm, but what would make people, society, change their behavior?
I don't think it's going to be market forces, right? So right. I'm personally very interested in, there are a number of startups out there who are trying to figure this out. They're trying to see essentially whether you can make money managing people's privacy. What does that look like? So I'm very interested to see whether those market mechanisms, because I don't know whether regulation is going to happen. So Europeans have a lot, a different view of privacy. And because they have certain regulations, we could have a whole show about the regulations over there. But there's been a lot of people, people say essentially Facebook and Google didn't come from Europe because of their regulations, because the regulations make it virtually impossible for startups and entrepreneurs to do what Google and Facebook do with all the data mining and analysis and behavioral advertising and searching and all that kind of stuff. The Europeans make it very, very difficult to do that, and so therefore none of those things were invented there. Now, I don't know whether that's necessarily true. The evidence speaks for itself to a certain degree. Generally, there's got to be some kind of reconciliation, though, because the internet, whenever you do something obviously on the internet, it's global. So you can't continue to have country by country, region by region, regulations and laws that apply to businesses that are by definition global because they're on the internet. And so we're in a space where that nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen. Lots of discussions, lots of cross-border this and meetings and hearings here and meetings there and all that kind of stuff. But nobody really knows what the eventual outcome is going to be, other than something has to happen, right? So now you have Bain suing Google, Germany saying, giving people the right to opt out of the Google Street View on map, variety of kind of individual country regulations against companies that are global. And I think that's unsustainable.
It's going to take a lot to shift.
Yes.
Q7 was, what are the costs of not doing privacy right? And you referenced Sony.
The other side of privacy is trust, right? So if you're a business, most businesses, right? So I'm not talking about every business, but most legitimate public-facing businesses care about trust. Trust is good. If you have the trust of your customers, then you hopefully are going to have more customers, and you're going to have customers staying for longer. The other side of that is privacy. So if people don't trust you, they don't understand what you're doing with their data, they don't understand how you're using their data, then they're not going to trust you. And if they don't trust you, they're not going to spend money with you. That's a big deal. So the cost, though, immediate costs are increasingly regulation around the world. So there's regulation around data breaches. So if you don't protect people's data and you lose people's data, you're going to get fined. But Sony, with PlayStation, the PlayStation Network, I mean, they, I think I heard something about $60 million hit that they announced in one of their earnings calls. I mean, that's huge, right? That's huge because they didn't invest in the appropriate security mechanisms and protecting people's data, which is part of the whole, part of the privacy spectrum. So that's a huge dollars and cents issue that is increasingly there. And then, you know, their reputation has been hit, which is almost immeasurable in terms of the drop in sales across all their product lines. So it's just something to really, really think about and to think about before rather than later.
Yeah, I think that's the key point today that I've learned. Let's start before. Think about it before rather than after the product has launched.
Right.
A letter retweeting of why privacy by design is a new corporate hotness. So Erica L. Anderson is a lawyer, and she's giving some legal insights on the side. One fact is that Google owns all docs on Google Docs, and there's already been litigation whether such docs are still private or privileged.
Amazing. I didn't know that, huh?
So that means that if we're using cloud services, that our data that we're placing into the cloud is owned by the services that are enabling us to do that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a big issue around intellectual property,
exactly.
Which I guess is a separate issue that's related.
Yes. Exactly. Many of the people who work in this, you know, there's the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and a lot of the work is done, obviously, by lawyers doing compliance work and stuff like that. So there's a lot of legal understanding, and we try to do that at applicationprivacy.org, is to give people an overview of, you know, the applicable laws, a lot more specific overseas. We do not have in this country what people refer to as a baseline consumer privacy legislation. So that's what a lot of those bills are trying to create. We have sector specific, right? So we have healthcare, we have HIPAA, we have financial services. They have their own privacy legislation, but there really is no other privacy legislation. It's very state by state, very piecemeal, or just doesn't exist.
The value of sharing is immense for both marketers and consumers alike. Prudence is key, though, is a comment from Jay Brett and Wapalunko. Erica is apologizing for being U.S.-centric.
Yes, I said, don't worry, it's fine.
Jay Brett and Wapalunko say they're seeing greater value in more sharing, but they just want to be able to control who and how their info is shared and how it is used. Erica says that regardless, if a company gets subpoenaed, they must turn over their info, or they must pay lawyers to fight. Wow. We had quite a lot of tweeting, a lot of information. There's a lot of ground we covered. Blog about this to continue the conversation. You can use this channel at JointIM to continue speaking. Thank you so much, Sean Dakin, for joining us today and for providing all this information. Why don't you tell us about Privacy Chat?
I co-host with a group here in Washington, D.C. called the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC. Every Tuesday at noon Eastern Time, we have a 45-minute privacy chat called Priv Chat, hashtag Priv Chat. I think I tweeted it out a couple of seconds ago. It's just every Tuesday, and we have about, we go for 45 minutes, and the questions are created by the community, though we are starting to have kind of guest speakers like you guys have as well. So we hope to have Jeff Jarvis come in a couple of weeks. He's just about ready to release a book called Public Part. Jeff Jarvis, and he wrote a book called What Would Google Do? And he writes a blog called Buzz Machine, and he's definitely a provocateur. So he's essentially making the argument for oversharing and sharing and how beneficial that is to society. It's a very interesting thesis.
Yeah.
Spare time, I'm building my own product as a product manager, building reverserobocall.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time. I'm glad this worked out. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to our caller. With Jason Brett, who called in. I don't know if he's still there. Please join us again, Sean, and I plan to join the privacy chat as well. This is information that we need to know about and stay up on. It's breaking news daily.
Wapalunko says that he's a little freaked out. Tons of new insights and knowledge, but he's a little bit scared.
Yeah, and I'm just going to tweet out something here about how the FTC's new DUF will impact developers. So that's a good resource for your audience here. So this was written specifically for app developers.
Excellent.
All right, good. Well, thank you guys very much. It was great great chatting and great to meet you guys, and appreciate the time.
Same here. Thank you.
Bye.
And we'll see you next week, Adrian.
Yes.
We may have a surprise speaker next week.
Really? Who?
I'll tweet out when it's confirmed.
Okay. Is he great?
All of our speakers are great.
No, but is he super, super great?
Remains to be seen.
Okay.
Great to have you back.
I'm looking forward to that.
And thank you to our listeners, and please check our website at www.prodmgmttalk.com. On our blog, we have recaps from recent talks, as well as the transcripts and the podcasts from our talks since we started adding the audio element. So thank you, everyone, for participating, and I will release the stats as soon as I get them in the next 10 minutes.